This is the Heartland Daily Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Heartland Soups Daily Podcast. I'm Sterling Burnett, Heartland Senior Fellow and Managing Editor of Environment and Climate News. I recently was a member of a live-streamed online international event hosted by the Creative Society, in which I was the lone non-scientist on a panel discussing climate change. One of my fellow participants was Dr. Arthur Villarido. I've known and admired Arthur's work for going on 7 years now. He recently retired as professor of geography at the College of Southern Maryland. Before that, he held positions at the University of Pittsburgh and George Washington University. And I brought him on to the Heartland Institute as a policy advisor way back in 2016. Arthur has published a number of peer-reviewed papers on the influence of undersea oceanic volcanic activity on climate change, the most recent of which he discussed during the live stream event and was published in the International Journal of Environmental Sciences and Natural Resources. That's what he's here to discuss today. Arthur, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. It's great to be here.
Art, for our listeners who may not be familiar with you or your work, please tell us a little bit about yourself, how your work in geography got you thinking about climate change.
Well, as a geographer, we're sort of trained in a number of different, what would be traditionally called earth science disciplines. So my doctoral work was at the University of Denver with a specialty in climatology, specifically applied climatology, remote sensing. I had opportunities to work with the Colorado State Climatologist. I also did some work up at the National Center for Atmospheric Research and have pretty much focused my teaching and my research in the areas of climate change, statistical research methods, and GIS. And as I was teaching my physical geography course, a question came up from a student. They asked some of the darndest questions, and he said, have we seen a change in earthquakes? And I said, well, the data from the USGS seems to show that there has been a jump, but I'll look a little further into it. And so I started to troll the databases of the USGS and an international consortium called IRIS, and found that there was, in fact, a significant increase in earthquakes. And I started to focus on different regions and different depths, and found that the mid-ocean regions saw a significant jump in earthquakes in 1995. It was statistically significant. The jump was large. This is what they call an almost intransitive system, meaning that the changes tend to be rather rapid. You don't get these gradual, steady changes. And I also noticed that the global temperatures also took a jump 2 years later in 1997. I said, there must be some sort of connection here. At the same time, this is when the Inconvenient Truth came out, and it was all gloom and doom. And as a student of the 70s, I realized that in the 70s, the gloom and doom was all about the global cooling. So I'm going, well, we're talking global warming. Now, they used to be talking global cooling. I'm noticing a linkage here between mid-ocean seismic activity and global temperatures. Let's explore that link a little further. And sure enough, I think I've come up with some rather interesting finds on that.
Well, we're going to get into some of that, but before we do, I want to be clear on where you stand for our listeners. There are varieties or degrees of skepticism regarding the theory that humans are responsible for climate change and whether its impacts on human well-being and ecosystem health will be negative. Some don't believe humans are playing any role in present climate conditions. I think there's very few people in that camp, but some do. Others think they have a modest impact. Still others think they are affecting climate, but it's not likely to be dangerous. And possibly an even beneficial one. And, of course, then there are those who believe humans are causing dangerous climate change. Where do you fall on the spectrum and why?
Well, I clearly discount the catastrophic global warming school of thought on this. I believe that CO2, of course, is the main culprit here. That is through fossil fuel use. We have increased the globe's loading of carbon dioxide. This is very, very well documented in the literature. However, the temperature changes don't really comport with the way CO2 has been changing. CO2 has had a very steady monotonic rise since the 50s when the Keeling curve came out. And temperature jumps have, temperature changes have been in jumps. And we can tie those jumps to certain geophysical phenomena. And I'm saying, okay, these are obviously linked, and the there's got to be a reason behind all this. Causality is many times hard to sort out of the data, but nonetheless, we have to be looking at those causes. So we're talking about CO2 here as the culprit from fossil fuel use. The impact on climate, as I believe, is small. As I like to tell people, I think that the carbon dioxide impact on climate is greater than zero. There is some impact on global temperatures, but it's less than statistically significant. I believe that other natural drivers far overpower and overwhelm the influence of anthropogenic carbon dioxide. There are some benefits to CO2. We know it's a plant fertilizer. The planet is greening as a result. It improves water requirements for plants. So we do know that there are positive things coming out of this. Now, this is all based on theories that were presented over 100 years ago. That is, carbon dioxide is what we call the greenhouse gas. It absorbs infrared radiation, and this, of course, can cause an atmosphere to warm. The question is a question of degree. How much?
Well, it's also it's also a question of all things being equal. It's yes, that in a closed system should have an impact, but it turns out the Earth isn't really a closed system. It's not like a greenhouse very much. You've got things coming in from outside the system. You've got all sorts of endemic changes, and the models seem to treat it as a closed system.
You're absolutely right about that. Yes, they are ignoring other inputs, other drivers, and other feedbacks to the system, and I think that's where the devil's in the details. So the question is, how effective is CO2 as on its own in causing global change? Well, first of all, if we look at the suite of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, we see that there are two dominant ones. Of course, water vapor is the most dominant, and carbon dioxide is a, shall we say, a weak sister in all this. The carbon dioxide absorption spectrum is really kind of pale in comparison to what water vapor is. Water vapor absorbs much more infrared radiation across a wider number of spectral bands. And so it molecule by molecule, water is a much more powerful absorber of infrared radiation. Secondly, water is far more abundant than water vapor, than carbon dioxide is. Water vapor constitutes a very large percentage of our greenhouse gases. This is a number that's rarely talked about. We talk about carbon dioxide is currently standing at around 420 parts per million, up from pre-industrial levels of 285 parts per million. And we've all seen the graphs where the number goes off the chart. And we say, well, 420 parts per million, that's a lot. We've seen a huge increase in this. And water vapor is 1% of the total atmosphere by volume, parts per million by volume. Well, if we do a little back of the napkin calculation on this, we see that at 1%, water vapor is at 10,000 parts per million. So we're looking at two greenhouse gases. One is at 10,000 parts per million. The other one is at 420 parts per million. But yet we're seeing CO2 as the driver of the system, and water vapor is what they call the feedback or the amplifier of the system.
Right.
And I think they have this all wrong. if we look at the anthropogenic load, Now, the ambient background CO2 level is about 285 parts per million. The anthropogenic load is about 1% of the total greenhouse load to our atmosphere. And that's really a remarkable number. So we're saying that this 1% of the greenhouse load into our atmosphere is the driver of global temperatures. And there's an interesting experiment that nobody seems to want to do or talk about. And it's looking at temperature changes in Antarctica. Because people, the model kind of works like this. You put some CO2 in the atmosphere, it causes a little bit of warming, which causes increasing evaporation, and then the water vapor kicks in and it amplifies and feeds back into the system. And that causes it to warm more, which amplifies it even further. But if you look at a place like Antarctica, you have virtually no water vapor in the atmosphere. That is the driest atmosphere on the planet. Because the temperature is that low, it can't hold an awful lot of water vapor. Yet in Antarctica, that is one of the monitoring stations for carbon dioxide. That and Mauna Loa are the two main CO2 monitoring stations. And we see, yes, the steady monotonic increase in CO2 in Antarctica in lockstep with what we see at Mauna Loa. And Antarctica now sits at 419 parts per million, slightly less than Mauna Loa. And yet, if we look at the satellite temperature record for Antarctica since 1979, despite significant increases in CO2 and virtually no impact from water vapor, the temperature changes in Antarctica are exactly zero. There has been no warming.
You know, I've never, that is news to me even. So thanks for that. But also, you got me thinking about Mauna Loa. Where these things are located may make a difference. Maybe uh-huh. not. I don't know. But Mauna Loa is in and around a number of pretty active volcanoes.
Yes, it is.
That are constantly putting out a variety of gases. Some mm-hmm. of them greenhouse gases, and mm-hmm. I'm wondering if that might affect measurements as well. It's like having a space telescope outside of a growing city. You know, I'm wondering how much pollution of the data is coming just from the location. But
that,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's an interesting point. I've been to Mauna Loa. I've been to the research station up there, and it's fascinating because, yeah, it's constantly venting steam. There's a constant venting of steam up there, and there are constant clouds coming up out of this. And yes, obviously, that is going to have some impact, but what is more interesting is that when you compare it with the South Pole data, which are the two main monitoring sites, they are virtually identical.
Hmm. Let me ask you this. So you've given us a little of the science and where you stand. But let's get to your paper, Arthur, because that's what that's where the rubber meets the road on our discussion today. Could you give our audience sort of a big picture overview of what you discuss in your recent paper? And the paper is titled 1995: An Important Inflection Point in Recent Geophysical History. So big picture overview.
Okay, the paper builds upon previous research that I've done linking changes in underwater seismic activity and global temperatures. As I said, the student asked me about this, and I started looking at the underwater activity, and it's like, this is really fascinating. The initial paper that I wrote on this back in 2016 was called The Correlation of Seismic Activity and Recent Global Warming. And I established the link between seismic activity along the mid-ocean ridges and global temperatures. And here is the key to this. That is, more earthquakes indicate more geothermal heat being released in these mid-ocean systems. The mid-ocean ridge and rise system of the planet is a 60,000-kilometer system, which is about almost 40,000 miles. Of undersea volcanoes that run through the entire planet, and this is where the vast majority of our geothermal heat is released. Now, as seismic activity along these ridges changes, the amount of geothermal heat will change with it. So an increase in seismic activity indicates an increase in geothermal heating, and a decrease, again, positively correlates, showing a decrease in geothermal heating. We do not have direct measurements as to how much heat comes out of there. We have estimates, but no direct measurements. But we know that the relationship is very strong. More seismic activity, more earthquakes undersea, equates to more geothermal heat release at the bottom. So,
A question. Is it just, we think of earthquakes, most people just, you know, it's like they think of earthquakes, they think of California or maybe Afghanistan, you know, places, you know, above the ground, and they don't associate them with volcanic activity. So on the subsurface, where you're talking about, is it just earthquakes or is there associated volcanic activity? So you've got heat releases from volcanoes as well undersea.
Right. What you have is the seismic activity that, yes, is related to undersea volcanoes. And the smaller ones are you have what's called hydrothermal venting.
Right.
These are vents that come up off the surface. They're miniature volcanoes, and you can see they're called black smokers. The temperature of the water can get up to 750 degrees Fahrenheit. White smokers are sort of about 350 degrees Fahrenheit. And you can see these plumes of material coming up out of these mid-ocean systems. So, yes, when we think of earthquakes, we tend to think of large events. These are very small events. So like a large earthquake would be a 6.5, for example. These are usually in the 4 to 6 range. These are small. They're rarely, if ever, felt on land. But our seismic network can pick them up. It can get down to about 4 on the what used to be called the Richter scale, so now called the moment magnitude scale. So we can pick these things up. And it's remarkable to see how this system lights up and then tones down over time. And nobody, I think I have compiled the only database on these underwater seismic events, many and most of which are linked to volcanic activity. And it's remarkable to see how this thing fluctuates over time. It's sort of like a breathing system. It almost looks like an EKG. To see that it goes up, it goes down, it has big dips, it has big valleys in it, and it ties in very, very closely with the global temperature records. What this does, the argument has been that there's not enough geothermal heat down there to make a difference on atmospheric temperature. But what it does is when you stir up the bottom water, it affects what is referred to as the thermohaline circulation. And the thermohaline circulation is a giant global conveyor belt. And that giant global conveyor belt hits a cul-de-sac in the Arctic. The net effect of all of this geothermal activity, and the literature is pretty well established on this, the net effect is to transport more heat into the Arctic. And transporting more heat into the Arctic kicks off a sequence of events that further amplify the warming. And this cascading of effects leads us to conclude that much of the recent warming is caused by this thermohaline intensification. The sudden jump in seismic activity, underwater seismic activity, occurred in 1995. And we see 2 years later, there was a corresponding jump in global temperatures. Also tied into this is that if the 1995 jump in mid-ocean seismic activity also is tied in with a number of geophysical processes, and that's what we take a look in the paper.
So it affects larger systems, sea surface geothermal activity and earthquakes, but it also just spot on, you know, at the location, and I would guess in and around the location of all these events, it heats the ocean directly, right?
Yes, it does.
You said 700 degrees with the black smokers, 300 degrees with the white smokers, and part of the measurement of global average temperatures that they are incorporating in, and rightly so, because the ocean makes up most of the Earth, is ocean temperatures. And so this is directly affecting ocean temperatures, and so it should affect the average ocean temperature, or am I wrong on that?
No, that is correct. It's a very small effect. In fact, this is one of the future research projects. We do know that the ocean temperatures are most heavily impacted in the North Atlantic. That's where it is. We also see some impacts in the Pacific Ocean, and that has an impact on El Nino events. But nonetheless, this is future research. We're parsing the data out. We're trying to look at different ridge segments and to see how ocean temperatures are affected, usually right after that, to see if we can start to isolate regional effects from this.
Right.
So it has a direct impact, yes, on ocean temperatures, but it also has an effect on the intensity of the thermal haline circulation. And that really, to me, is the key to all of this.
Okay. So it affects ocean temperatures in at least two ways.
And, yes.
And if ocean temperatures are part of the estimated rise in global temperatures, then it has an impact on that that, as far as I can tell, looking at the literature, is not being accounted for.
You're absolutely right. It's not.
Okay. So in your work, Art, you reviewed the literature in a variety of scientific disciplines. Could you please name some of them?
Sure. A review of the literature came from a variety of geophysical specialties to include seismology. I've had discussions with seismologists on my work here. Marine geology, we have to look at the nature of these eruptions, where do they occur, what kinds of magmas do they produce, what are the temperatures of these magmas. Oceanography, I've had to do a deep dive, pun intended, into the oceanographic literature. The oceanographic literature is it's enormous, and it can be phenomenally challenging to work through this. Some of these articles, you know, seawater is, and it's 12 pages of differential equations, pretty remarkable stuff. Of course, climatology, I've had to link in with temperature databases. In fact, I've got a whole array of databases that I work with. I've settled upon working with the satellite temperature data. It appears to be by far the most accurate and has the best spatial coverage. Glaciology, I have to look at what's going on with the snow and ice parameters. And also geodesy. The geodetic information on this, because we see that post-1995, shortly thereafter, there were significant impacts on the what is called the dip pole, which is the northern hemisphere magnetic pole, and also actual true north, geographic north, actually shifted slightly after 1995.
So you just mentioned one of them. What were some of the documented shifts in the Earth's atmosphere system that occurred on or shortly after 1995 that lead you to conclude endemic natural factors on Earth play a critical role in driving a spike in temperature shortly thereafter that has remained higher than before and relatively stable today?
The documented shifts, there's a long list of shifts that are abundantly documented in the literature, and we'll start at the beginning. We saw the abrupt increase in mid-ocean seismic activity. That started in 1995 and peaked in 1997 and has stayed at elevated levels since then. We see the lagged two-year increase in global temperatures. That started in 1997. We see a rapid shift of what we call the AMO, which is the Atlantic Multi-Decadal Oscillator. It flipped from positive to negative. It measures North Atlantic temperatures. And at precisely the 1995 demarcation point, the AMO flipped from a negative phase, that is a cool phase, to a warm phase. This is well documented in the literature. We saw a punctuated increase in North Atlantic hurricanes. We saw a sudden jump in hurricanes commencing in 1995. We also saw a jump in North Atlantic, what we call the ACE, accumulated cyclone energy. So there were more hurricanes, and they became slightly more intense than they were shortly prior to that. We saw a significant change in the dynamics and the variability of the Northern Hemisphere summer monsoon, and we saw amplifications of El Nino. 1997 was the strongest El Nino on record, 2 years after the seismic activity spiked upward. We saw a rapid strengthening of what's called the AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. That is the branch of the thermohaline circulation that penetrates into the North Atlantic and into the Arctic. We saw sudden changes in the spring and fall Arctic temperatures, followed by a large jump in winter temperatures. We saw sharp sea ice declines in the Arctic and the subarctic, again, these related to the temperature changes that were occurring in the Arctic region. We saw accelerated ice loss for the Greenland ice sheet. We saw an abrupt decline in cloud cover over Greenland during the summer months. That makes perfect sense. As you raise the temperatures, you raise the atmosphere's capacity to hold water vapor. Therefore, less of it condenses and more of it stays in the vapor state. We saw sudden changes in the rate of the northern dip pole. That is, the northern magnetic pole shifted dramatically. In fact, it was the largest shift in the magnetic north pole, which was constantly wandering around. Since 1591, we've had that data going back, and it doubled from the 1994 levels. In 1995, we saw a doubling of that shift in 1996. And finally, we saw a rapid directional shift of the Earth's true North Pole. Again, all of this is well documented in the literature. So here's what we conclude from all. This is the concluding statement of the paper. We say, an increase in the mid-ocean seismic activity in 1995 is indicative of greater geothermal flux along the globe's mid-ocean spreading zone. And this heightened flux intensifies the thermohaline circulation, resulting in a strengthening of the meridional overturning circulation in the Atlantic. And this process, by the way, I had a name for this process called Atlantification, discussed in the literature at length. This gives rise to higher Arctic and North Atlantic sea surface temperatures. These higher sea surface temperatures were expressed as a shift in the multi-decadal oscillator from a negative to a positive phase, creating an environment that was conducive to an increased frequency of North Atlantic hurricanes, a significant jump in the accumulated energy of those hurricanes, stronger monsoons, and amplified El Nino episodes. These changes indicated a diminution of Arctic sea ice, reduced cloud cover in the Greenland sector, and rising Arctic temperatures in the fall, spring, and winter seasons. All of those things are well documented in the literature and in the data sources that underpin that literature.
So, Art, if you're right, research in what areas of study should be critical to understanding of current climate change? And how much impact will ending or sharply reducing the use of fossil fuels use to halt greenhouse gas emissions have on climate change?
I'll answer the second part of that question first. I don't think restricting fossil use is going to have an impact at all. In fact, let me quote to you from an article called The Impact of CO2, H2O, and Other Greenhouse Gases on Equilibrium Earth Temperatures. This was published very recently. I can send you the link to that. The study concludes that CO2 is what they call a bit player. The study also concludes that the 140 parts per million increase since the Industrial Revolution has warmed the Earth by 0.24 degrees Celsius. That's less than a half a degree Fahrenheit. And further increases to the CO2 will have an increasingly diminishing impact. It's the window shade analogy that people like Richard Lindzen talk about. If you pull a window shade down, it's going to block out some sunlight. If you pull a second window shade down, it's going to block out a little bit more. And you get diminishing returns on pulling down more window shades. Same with CO2. So we can, I don't think, the CO2 increases are going to have a significant impact at all. So I think we have to continue to verify the linkages between the mid-ocean seismic activity and global temperatures. I monitor this on a continuous basis. We need to build more data on ocean depth temperatures. We're starting to build, with the Creative Society, we're starting to build a database of ocean temperatures at depth. This will give us a three-dimensional view of what is happening with the sea surface temperatures. We need to begin to establish strengths and mathematical relationships between mid-ocean activity and the thermal haline strength, snow and ice dynamics, the monsoon and El Nino dynamics, hurricane frequencies and strength, and cloud cover, particularly in the Arctic. And all of this was tied together very, very nicely by who I think was probably one of the greatest earth scientists to ever live, Alfred Wegener. He was the author of a book on continental drift. He was the sort of the quote unquote founding father of the modern theory of plate tectonics. And Wegener stated back in 1929, and I'll quote from him, "Scientists still do not appear to understand sufficiently that all Earth sciences must contribute evidence towards unraveling the state of our planet. It is only by combing the information furnished by all the Earth sciences that we can hope to determine truth here. Further, we have to be prepared always for the possibility that each new discovery, no matter what science furnishes it, may modify the conclusions we draw." And I think this should be the guiding credo for people who are interested in studying the Earth's climate into the future.
Well, Dr. Arthur Vitorito, it's been an important discussion. Some interesting things have come out. We've been pleased you could be with us today. I want to thank you on behalf of myself and our listeners.
Thank you very much, Sterling. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Listeners, thanks for checking in on us today. Please check Heartland's website as we follow the work of Dr. Arthur Vitorito and the progress of energy and environmental laws and regulations that affect you. And go frequently to our Policy Bot site, your one-stop shop for free market solutions to public policy problems. In addition, if you're not already receiving these podcasts daily on your favorite device, go to iTunes and subscribe. And when you have the time, please rate our podcast on iTunes so you can help us expand the reach of free market ideas. Thanks. Take care. Bye.